Welcome to the Packet Pushers podcast, a technical podcast about data networking published several times per month, sometimes even weekly. Packet Pushers is a unique and nerdy deep dive on technical and engineering matters in the world of networking, tackling topics about the industry, vendors, and networking technology. Packet Pushers is a unique place where we don't apologize for being willfully technical or willing to ask complex questions, discuss vendor marketing, and generally get nerdy about network. As once again, I'm Greg Farrow. You might know me as the host of the Packet Pushers podcast, writer at Ethereal Mind, and general busybody about the networking industry. Also with us this week is Ethan Banks. How are you today, sir?
Well, I'm sitting here with you in a lounge on the fifth floor of the Radisson in San Jose, gathered for networking field day five. That's how I am, trying out this new recording rig. So we're really hoping that the bits are going to a flash drive right about now.
And that'd it's very great. Odd to look into your eyes, you know.
We can hardly look at your eyes too. Yeah, it's kind of creepy now.
Creepy, yeah.
Got to be honest about
it. It got a bit weird. It's a bit hard, you know. Yeah. No pants were harmed in the making of this show. So there you go. Also with us today is Josh O'Brien. Josh, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hey, Greg. Josh O'Brien. I'm writer over at staticnat.com, and a lot of you see me on Twitter at Josh O'Brien 77. Yeah, on Twitter.
Yep, you've been joining us once again. And also with us today is Brandon Carroll.
Hey, how's it going? At Brandon Carroll on Twitter and BrandonJCarroll.com, where I'm blogging lately.
Right.
And man, I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah.
It's sunny San Jose.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it's quite nice outside. It is actually been, the weather's pretty good, and it's pretty cool. So it's good to have you, good to see you at the event. And also with us today is Tom Hollingsworth.
Good to see you guys again in the flesh and not talking over Skype for once. you can follow me at networkingnerd.net. My Twitter handle is networkingnerd, and I've just flown in for Network Field Day 5. Cue the boy or my arm's tired joke.
Cue the sitting in an airplane chair. In a chair on an airplane, it's always like, yeah, I want that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you really want to be sitting. So today's show is really, because everybody's here and in a room, we want to be searching for topics that we could take on that the audience would want to be able to talk about. Something. Well, we've been getting a lot of emails lately from the audience about what is the next generation of networking going to look like. We've seen over the last 5 years, we've seen virtualized networking come into play. And then recently we've seen the rise of the cloud. And then in networking in particular, we've been talking about software-defined networking in the show constantly, fairly much about open flow and network controllers and that type of technology. So where is it going to take us? Like, we know that SDN and cloud is all the rage, and we've got a lot of vendors coming out with products over the next 6 months. If you think you're bored of listening to SDN now, wait until you see what happens in the next year. It's going to be like, you know, it's going to be like, at this particular point in time, it's reminding me of the MPLS. When MPLS hit the market in 2002, 2003, like when Cisco first started talking about it in 1998, 99, and by 2001, 2002, MPLS became a thing. It was just everything had to have MPLS. It was always, you know, whatever it was. And I think we're going to see something along that sort of titanic scale coming to things. But the challenge is that software-defined networking is not a thing. It's not a technology. MPLS defined a particular technology subset, and everybody knew what MPLS was. It did this one thing. It was tag switching. It was ability to do one thing. SDN is far more amorphous, far more whatever. So what we wanted to do is just talk a little bit about where the next generation of networking is coming to us and what does it mean, particularly the readers who've been writing into us have been writing in saying, what does it mean to the day-to-day? What does it mean to you as an engineer? What does it mean to your career choices, your study choices maybe? You know, what are you going to do to make sure you don't get left behind in those types of technologies?
Yeah, and part of the challenge here is that SDN as a term means everything and nothing all at the same time, because all the vendors are changing their definition of what SDN is to make it very compatible with their product set. So you hear software-defined networking, and what's that mean? And some people have a very strictened definition of what SDN is. Oh, it's a centralized controller that can see the entire network and then program it to forward traffic in a particular way, and that's software-defined networking. And other people change the definition to make it say it's more like, we can program the network with an API, and that's what it means. You know, that's software-defined networking. And other people who just get snarky and say, well, we've been using software-defined networking because by golly, OSPF is software, and isn't that what that means? You know, which isn't really the point at all as far as the industry is concerned, but some people have made that point. And then you combine the SDN really arose because of cloud, all the stuff going on in the cloud and problems within the cloud that software-defined networking is supposed to solve. And so you've got this convergence of cloud being a new form of networking, people looking at their data centers and going, do I even need to have my own data center anymore? Is that even a wise thing, a smart thing? Or should I maybe look at an Amazon or a Rackspace or somebody like that, put all my apps up there, have everything be in the cloud? And then you get a network engineer sitting back here and going, so what does that mean to me if I don't have my own data center anymore, if I don't have my own computer room? What do I do next so that my career continues forward? One place to start maybe is considering all these announcements that all these vendors have been making, Cisco and Juniper and Brocade, just looking at a list from a listener that he sent to us, Plexi, Big Switch, Arista, and others with a ton of startups out there in the SDN space. First of all, who is going to come out on top of this thing? So what we're trying to do is figure out, from a network engineering perspective, is there a company that we should all be maybe getting behind and trying to figure out how they're doing it?
So I have a question here. Who's going to come out on top is really a matter of what you define by who. There's 1,000 startups out here that are doing something in the form of SDN, and they're the little tiny minnows swimming around in the ocean just waiting to get gobbled up by somebody. So if you define survivorship as still being around in 3 to 5 years – a lot of places are going to survive because they're going to get subsumed by the VMwares, the Junipers, the Ciscos of the world because, oh, hey, they're doing something really awesome that I want to keep working on, but I can't develop the in-house expertise necessary to do that. So, you know, we innovate by buying people.
Now, we're seeing that already.
But if you want to say of the names, if the name is still there, who's going to still be around? I think it's going to be a lot of your old industry stalwarts, the Junipers, the Ciscos, the Brocades, even the HPs of the world.
But there's an interesting point there. It doesn't have to be that because there's a possibility that today networking has to be very much – you have to be Cisco-sized or Juniper-sized or Brocade-sized to be able to go and make a thing and get a box manufactured and a power supply manufactured and the silicon chips designed and tested and validated. And then you need a software team to be able to bring a product to market. But that doesn't mean – with software-defined networking and the concept of using an external software package to program it, the future might be you buy a Brocade switch, but you buy a software package from another company and use that to program the Brocade network that you own. It's not necessarily going to have to be
It's not necessarily going to be that, but the likelihood
today, of that is very slim because most of us in the marketplace have had a decade of being taught to buy from one vendor.
Well, even more than that, though, there's so many the API structures as we're looking at them being applied to these switches are all unique vendor to vendor because not everybody's writing to OpenFlow because their hardware doesn't support it at the moment, typically, or doesn't support it especially well.
No. Here's what scares me about that. When you say that you could buy any software package and run it on your Brocade network, that sounds to me like I buy Apple products because I like the hardware, but I'm running Windows on everything. Is that what we're looking at? I mean,
yeah, pretty much.
Why would I do that?
It's a bit more complicated than that because what you might actually have is a physical network that delivers a series of functions. So the silicon has a bunch of functions in it. Conceptually, like an Intel server, equally supports Linux and Windows. You can choose whichever. Mm. But above that, you've got whatever application that it is still using the Intel hardware. Now, some applications use none of the features in the Intel. Like, for example, today in networking, if you're a networking person and you're tracking the latest generation of Intel CPUs, they have a thing called the DPDK device driver development kit, which is specifically optimized to make an Intel CPU as a networking processor. This is the Intel x86, you know, thing that we all know and whatever. And you can take a bare-bones Intel motherboard, and it's a 40 gigabit per second line rate packet processor in that thing. Now, if you think that you could put Windows on top of that and then have an app that uses that to turn it into a firewall, now that's not going to happen because Windows is not the right operating system to be able to make a firewall. But we could go back. We stopped doing that back in the late 90s. In the late 90s, we had Checkpoint running on Windows, and that was the firewalls platforms that we had, right? There's no reason why we can't go back to that model if there's enough processing power in an Intel platform. The days of having to have a vendor integrated stack where Cisco's management platform was working on Cisco's operating system on Cisco's hardware is not necessarily a mandatory feature of the future.
It isn't, but they're being built that way at the moment. I think that's what we're seeing. Now, some of the third parties, like a Big Switch, end up being a more generic arbiter that third parties can write to. So you can have a bunch of guys that are going to write to the Big Switch API that, and then let Big Switch be the arbiter in the middle that then programs OpenFlow switches down underneath. You've got a player like I'll bring up Anuta because I've been working with them and their product is fresh in my mind that will take instructions from a policy engine and then push that down into Cisco firewall and Nexus switches and an F5 load balancer, let's say. So you've got that kind of a model as well where there's some players that are kind of trying to be a generic man in the middle that's going to arbitrate between an app up in the northbound direction and the hardware underneath in the southbound direction. But then you've also got Cisco with the one controller and HP with their controller.
Van.
Yes, the Van controller. That are doing something very specific to their hardware and it's branded and it's not necessarily you know, broadly supported across the industry because that's all going to be a little bit unique and there's no particular standard. There's not a northbound API standard. They're not even talking about one. And in the southbound direction, it's all over the place because OpenFlow is far from ubiquitous. So, I mean, I think we can make a point here that as far as who to bet on, you can bet on the big vendors just because you kind of, in a gut sense, know they're going to be around. Yeah. But it's very hard to get behind a particular technology because we don't know what it's going to be yet.
Yeah. So I've got a really different view on all of this. Around who's going to win and who's not, it's all about the solution set you need. I'm not a CCIE. I get to run with you guys because somehow I get to run with you guys once in a while. But I go after solutions I need. I don't go after vendors. I don't pay a whole lot of attention to a lot of the SDN errata because it doesn't pertain to my business at this point in time. Some of it will at some point, but there's a lot of stuff still washing out. At the end of the day, all the big vendors are still going to be in place. At the end of the day, all these little fish that we're talking about are going to get gobbled up or have a controller, but if it doesn't serve your purpose, it's going to be kind of moot. And I think we're going to talk more about, you know, what we should kind of bet on in the future as network engineers. But as far as a vendor, you need to be going after what solves a problem, not after what the marketing literature tells you you should be doing. I'm not anti-Cisco. I sold Cisco for a lot of years, but I'm betting heavily on Juniper right now because Juniper solves my business use. But I'm not betting heavily in the Juniper data center switching because it doesn't. It's too big of a scale for me. So I'm betting on Arista as my data center switching, and the rest of my architecture is Juniper. So I don't know that there's going to be a particular winner in the SDN play.
Yeah, you make the very good point that there are engineers out there who are trying to figure out how to skill up so that they stay relevant and can maintain their income level and so on and grow. And then there's designers who are looking at the network from a different perspective. Well, it's not about a specific skill set just so I'm relevant out there. It's about what do I have to buy to make this thing do what it needs to do, this thing being some application that the business requires so that the business can run. Which are two different problems to solve in a way. So that is, it goes back to there is no one right answer.
Yeah, and I think if I'm going to, I like the idea of get a solution that solves my need. I agree with that. But the problem that I have with that is it's you're still limited in the vendors that you can look at because you're not going to, if there's a real small startup that can solve your need, I may not choose them because I don't know if they're going to be around next year. And what happens with this investment I just made in a product and then next year they're not around or, you know, they've been acquired and that product line has been killed off and it's been merged into something else and things have changed and my support is different. So I still look at it from that angle too.
So I've been hearing a lot of that lately. I was an early adopter of Nutanix, which is a storage product, not networking, so I'm not going to dive into it. But I did my research. I looked into who they were funded by. I looked into what they were doing, who the principals were. I did my research, and then I chose them. Yeah. And it was a risk, and it's a risk that's paid off very well for me. But then the same way, we can look at Meraki and Cisco, and a lot of people bet on Meraki. And a lot of people are kicking themselves right now for betting on Meraki, and not because the technology's changed, and not because they've went out of business, but because I don't care what Cisco says, all that gear is going to get SmartNet in the next 5 years.
And that was one of the things that they didn't plan on when they invested in Meraki.
With the Meraki hardware is gone. Cisco bought Meraki absolutely. For its cloud platform. The Meraki hardware was, you know, they're not going to end of life it today, but they'll leave it sell out, but there won't be any more development of it. And when people stop buying it, they'll be switched over to Cisco. The Meraki platform is clearly going to be a cloud management platform for the SMB space.
But to your point, Brandon, I don't disagree. I think very clearly you've got to be intelligent about what products you're choosing. Yeah. Not only do they have to fit a need, there's a lot of things that I could do for my business right now that would solve a problem that I really don't think are the way forward.
Okay, let me ask you a question. You're running a data center and you're the CTO of a platform that's mm-hmm. providing a service, right? So in your networking space, you've got using VMware or using?
Using VMware.
Using VMware. So you've got the vSwitch and the VDS.
No.
That's your virtual networking.
I bet against that in the beginning because we're a small enough environment. I didn't have to, but I am getting ready to go to the VDS.
VDS. Yeah. So your vSwitch.
I'm vSwitch right now. I will be moving to VDS in the next 6 months.
Okay. So does that work for you? Do you find that that's good enough?
I do think it is, and especially after what VMware has done in the last year. But again, I'm a very point data center. What I do is my product. I'm not talking about lots of disparate workloads. I'm not talking about multi-tenancy yet. Mm-hmm. Multi-tenancy is coming into my platform very soon. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, I might have to rethink a lot of this. Multi-tenancy, I think, in the data center and cloud space changes the entire equation.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really does.
From experience, huh, Greg?
Yeah.
Why are you building your own infrastructure and not putting it up in someone else's cloud?
Oh, that one's easy. Expense, and I don't trust it. Right now, we are getting ready to spin up a space in Las Vegas in a well-known data center out there. And in talking about that, talking about doing cloud recovery and doing some maybe Glacier for backups of just just dead data effectively, I had a very well-known private cloud provider reach out to me and go, "We can beat that. We can beat the ROI and everything else." And they sent me the numbers back, and they can beat my ROI if my ROI is like 40 years from now. So I don't really think we're not at an inflection point where the costs. And especially for mid to large, now maybe on mass scales. So maybe if you're Coke or you're SAP or you're doing some of that stuff, maybe it makes a lot of sense to outsource that or have secondaries in that space. And I'm even looking at them as a tertiary data center. I don't want to have to keep building out big data structures. My data structures for my business are about networking. So I need an East Coast hub and I need a West Coast hub so I can land my clients at geographically relevant points because I do a lot of video work and milliseconds mean a lot to me. As far as data structures and full resiliency, if I would lose those two main data centers or I would lose one of them, then a tertiary data center that's a cloud provider and somebody else's infrastructure makes sense. Again, I think this all comes down to use case. And I think people need to get past marketing and get to use case.
So that's called a hybrid cloud solution. And then you've got a problem because if you've got vSwitches, just to turn this around, this is something I've been working on a lot. So if you've got your own custom data center and you're using vSwitches, and then you want to have a hybrid, you want to burst into somebody else's facility as an emergency or as a short case, you've got a real networking challenge to decide how to handle that because your apps either have to be able to just re-IP address themselves and rename themselves so that the user can access it when the hybrid cloud part of it's actually activated. And the vSwitch doesn't cut that.
Yeah. Neither
does VDS.
Okay.
Because if you're going to try and keep the IP address the same and you're going to move it into a hybrid cloud, you've actually got to rebuild the entire front end of your data center, right?
And again, that's where I say because we're making the assumption that the Nicira acquisition doesn't start changing the entire networking model within VMware. And I'm not sold on VMware. I'm not sold on VDS or any of these. Again, these are point solutions for me.
See, to me, SDN is all about the virtual switch at the moment. So I know what my physical switches can do, and I know I can go in and create MPLS, I can do dynamic routing, but ultimately my physical network still has the IP address has to be in one place because I have to have a MAC address exists on a physical port, the IP address exists where the MAC address is. But what I have is virtual switches somewhere at the end. Today it's vSwitch or VDS, or for other people it's Open vSwitch, and for other people it's in Hyper-V, they've got their switch, right? The trick is that if you've now got a data center that's got some Hyper-V and you've got a VMware and you want to move a VM from Hyper-V to VMware or back again for whatever reason, and that's a use case that's becoming more common for some enterprises are saying, I will have VMware for this but Hyper-V for this because the price of Hyper-V is cheaper than VMware by a lot.
By a lot.
And so a lot of enterprises are now saying, well, I'll build VMware, and over here that's where my mission-critical stuff will go, but all my secondary tier will go into the Hyper-V. And I think in a couple of years that'll be OpenStack. But now you've got a networking problem because you've now got a physical network infrastructure, you've got the VMware network infrastructure, and you've got the Hyper-V networking infrastructure. You've actually built three networks, and you've got to bring them all together, right? Now, the second trick you've got is that if you start having network services like firewalls, IPSs, load balancers, where do they then sit? Do they sit in the physical network, and then you've got to bring it out of the Hyper-V cloud up to the firewall to bring it back down to the VMware cloud? Or do you then start putting firewalls in each side and then trying to work out, and how do you, now if you burst something from the NV, you know, from the Hyper-V side into the VMware side, how does that know that that IP address is now over there? And that's the problems that SDN is working to solve. Now, that's not a problem for you today. And it's not even a problem.
But it will be.
But it will be, right?
Yep.
Because you will have a problem where you're building your data centers because it's still cheaper for you to fill your own racks. And you can cost manage those and you know exactly where you are. That's absolutely, personally, I still think that's the best way for most people to go today. But there's a lot of companies now who are saying, I don't want to drop, I've got to either refurb my existing data center. I've got a data center I built 20 years ago. It's 3.5 kilowatts per rack. And not an uncommon story, right?
Nope.
You've got a data center. It's 3.5 kilowatts. You put one Nexus 7000 in there, and you're burning 8 kilowatts to run a Nexus 7000 with a fair few modules in it. So how do you refurb the, you know, a UCS chassis pulls 2.5 kilowatts for an 8-blade chassis. I'm not sure what the HP blade loadout is or any of those, but it's all sort of, you know, you need at least a 7-kilowatt rack to have enough to make the density work out. So that means shutting your data center down and rewiring the entire power. You can't just do one row at a time, one shaft, you know, it's a whole. So if you're then going to go and build another data center, are you going to drop $20 million or are you going to go and rent something that's going to cost you $2 million a year?
Now, Tom, you deal with a lot of small, medium customers. That's about right, right?
Yes.
Are you seeing people that are asking you, can I just move this stuff into the cloud and does that make sense? And what are you telling them?
Yes. I have a lot of my customers who live in a very big bullseye for natural disasters. So they are always asking me, let's just say, for instance, a tornado wipes out all of our schools or my entire office building. Can I set it so that these workloads move into a hosting provider somewhere, into a bunker out of state? And my response is, yes, you can do that. Let me see your pocketbook, because that's not a cheap solution based on what you want to do. Because they're looking at Amazon and saying, well, Amazon's pretty cheap. I'm like, yeah, but you have to play by Amazon's rules. That was one of the things I heard when I went to VMware Partner Exchange last week, was VMware and Amazon are now on the outs with each other, because though, like Greg was saying with his VMware and Hyper-V example, once you transfer a workload into that, it doesn't come back out easily. And those are one-way trips for most people right now.
Yeah.
That's where SDN is going to come into play. Is it's going to be like the parent in a room full of kids and go, all right, everybody has to play nice now. All right, you get to play with this workload. You get to play with that workload. You'll switch up in a little bit. You know, those kinds of things. That's why I'm kind of advising my customers to take a very wait and see approach to moving all of their things into the cloud, because I'm afraid that they're going to find out in 6 to 9 months that, oh, hey, by the way, those are our servers now. We're not going to let you have them back.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a use case there, though, for some businesses to move certain apps up there, like Google. You can take advantage of the Google App Suite, Mail, Docs, a lot of basic business functionality right there.
Now, for a point system,
yeah,
and I'll give you a specific use case. A lot of my customers use demand-driven databases, student information systems. They'd look like CRMs to most normal people. And their response is, well, do I host that on site and buy a brand new server and do all this stuff, or do I just have the company host it? And I'm like, you know what? For pain and effort, have the company host it, because your network is not going to be able to survive an outage or some kind of mission-critical failure. And the customers who have decided to host it themselves have called me at 10:30 at night because they had a load balancer go down, or because someone fat-fingered a route in their service provider. And it's kind of nice to be able to look at somebody else and go, it's your problem now. Mm. But I don't recommend moving everything up there just yet, because I'm one of those people who puts his toe in the water a little bit at a time until I'm all the way in. I'm not going to just cannonball into the cloud.
Brandon, I know you have a strong security background, CCIE security, right?
Yep.
What's your take on the state of security in the cloud now? And we're going to come back around to a bigger question in a minute here, which is tying all this back to what network engineers should be thinking about. But I wanted to hit on the security thing.
Yeah. Well, Greg and I were talking about that a little bit beforehand. And state of security, I don't know.
Did you change your Evernote password yet?
Hold on.
Yes, let me do that real quick.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I couldn't give you an intelligent answer because I honestly don't know where it's going. I don't know.
And that's part of the frustration of it. While it's easier to build up the transport within cloud and to set up multi-tenancy within cloud, when you get down to strict lines of separation and proving out how that's all being done, those are harder questions for the providers to answer. Yeah. And there's different solutions built around that for sure. I know Greg's been right in the thick of that and what you're dealing with.
But the flip side of doing security in the cloud is you've got a whole bunch of different tools. So, you know, as we were talking earlier, right? Today, if you want to do some security, you put a firewall at critical points in your data center, and then you design the network to force everything through the firewall. Now, that was all right when your physical machine was in one place. So you could say this switch belongs in this zone, and then we invented VLANs and then said, well, this VLAN belongs in this zone, so all the traffic has to be forced through the firewall. So then we've got a control point, we can put an IPS on that and a packet capture device, so if we need to do any investigation or any, you know, analytics on those sorts of forensics on those things, we can do that there. But in a cloud or in a virtualized platform, right, and maybe you've got a DRS environment and you've got, say, 10 blades and an affinity group set up where all this application belongs in there, well, that's a zone, but you don't know exactly where the servers are and you don't know where the firewall you can no longer say my packets go from Josh to Brandon and there's a defined path between them and I can control that.
And right? Here's the firewall.
And here's the firewall enforcing policy between the two.
Yeah.
The challenge now is that in a virtualized environment, we're going to have your average medium-sized enterprise is going to have 100 servers. They're going to run a 20-to-1 compression ratio. That is 20 servers per engine. So 100 servers, that's 2,000. And your virtual workload, let's say we're sticking with VMware and you've got VDS and you've got the whole vMotioning DRSing around the group of the 100 servers. So where's my web server in that?
Right.
Right. Where's the load balancer? If the web server's over here on server number 80 and the load balancer's on the other side of the data center in server number 20,
yeah.
What's the network look like between that configuration? Where's the internet connection that's the dirty pipe?
Yeah.
How are you going to – and then start to think about things like, well, where does the IDS go when I've got 3,000 servers all sharing the same physical server in the network? So in my virtual – because that's where we need to get to. Because what you really want to be able to say is I want to go to a rack of servers, turn it off, migrate the loads off, shut it down, replace them, and then turn it back on and just add them back into the group. I shouldn't have to do this arcane – you know, you start thinking about servers as racks of functionality. Mm-hmm. And that's what Nutanix is doing, right?
So, yeah, absolutely.
Although a little bit differently. But
yeah. Well, the best story I've heard around security so far, and by no means is this my expertise, but this is just me trying to figure out how to defend my environment as I go from this old classic environment that we're all used to a private cloud environment that I'm building, and then merging to public-private hybrid as we'll be doing in the next year or so. And that's been Juniper. And I don't even remember the name of the product, but it's their ESX firewall shim.
Yeah, SRX.
So now it's not even the virtual SRX. It's a product they bought.
Okay.
And
LTOL?
Maybe, but it sits at the hypervisor layer, and it has full exposure to everything, and it uses their intelligence layer to start grouping things in. And as boxes move from, you know, host A to B, the policies are moving with it.
Yeah.
And that's the most intelligent one I've heard. I'm sure there's others out there. They're just the only ones I stood still long enough to listen to.
So that's a virtual firewall, right?
Or
software firewall. In reality, it's a software firewall.
Yeah.
Because the way that works is you have a shim layer sitting in the hypervisor.
Absolutely.
In the fast path. And when the first time a flow comes in, that shim then diverts it off to an SRX firewall instance running in a VM, usually on the box, right? Or it can be a physical SRX firewall somewhere. And they do a policy lookup and say, if I do inspection on this, does it match a predetermined firewall rule? And then it loads a yes, no, you know, pass, fail, back down to the fast path. And so then all the packets. And so if a VM moves from server A to server B, physical server A to physical server B, then the policy can go with it.
Right.
Because all you're translating is pass-fail for this defined flow. It's just, you know, you get a bunch of flow data and it goes with it, right? And that's a good way of doing it, but what you've actually done is there's no physical firewall in there because you're not actually passing it through a hardware firewall like we used to do.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is the future for virtualized data centers, but not for cloud data centers.
Well, I think there's another challenge too, and I mean, when we say virtualized and cloud, when we get all cloudy, I get all cynical because we've been doing cloud for a long time. It's just a different utilization, and yes, we've got OpenStack and we have new sets of structures coming around it, but this is an extension of what we've been doing for a long time.
Okay.
I think one of the biggest challenges I have when it comes down to saying how we're going to do one thing one way or the other, how long did it take for Cisco to come out with a 1K for Hyper-V? I mean, we've got these things that we've been going down paths with one vendor, but these other vendors are doing things in parallel. I don't think the network vendors are doing a really good job about keeping up with the emerging platforms. I think in order to reach your kind of nirvana that you're talking about, that you move it out of Hyper-V and into ESX and into OpenStack, whatever that might be, we've got to have a similar set of tools. And if a vendor is going to get into this, they need to really get into this, and they need to play by the same rules with all the people. They need to quit looking where their investors are, and they need to play at the same rules.
That was difficult because Cisco didn't want to get into writing software for VMware and for Hyper-V and for KVM, right? But they should have.
They absolutely should have.
Right?
Yeah. And the only thing that's really common between the vendors right now is the concepts. And that's about the best you can say. As a network engineer, you're looking at all this stuff going, what should I learn? What should I be working on? Is there some cert I can go get that's going to make me ready for the brave new networking world? All the vendors are doing something a little bit different, or in some cases, really friggin' different, depending on what their approach is and what the problem is that they're trying to solve. And so you can't go and say, if I learn these RFCs, I'm going to understand what this whole virtualization cloud and SDN thing is all about. Because you're not, because those RFCs don't exist. What you have is an endless series of point solutions that some of which are very large that accomplish some specific task, and you're buying a whole system. A lot of the big products now that are billed as SDN are really very large orchestration and policy management and configuration kind of systems all working together, often with a controller, and then configuring your network for you and maintaining it and monitoring it and doing resource management and doing reporting, and if it's cloud provider, doing billing. And that's what you're buying. That's really what you're buying. That's not standards based. That's a software solution. Someone sat down and wrote this and put it on a box and plugged into a whole bunch of APIs to make it work, and maybe wrote their own API that other partners of theirs are writing to come up with this overall solution. In the traditional sense of what we've been doing for networking for a long time, that isn't networking. It's something else. And it's very hard to put your finger on one thing and go, this is the thing to go after, other than saying concepts. Better figure out what virtualization is. If that's passed you by, it's time you get a real handle on what VMware does and what a vSwitch is and how it factors into the hypervisor and what service chaining is and what it does and who plays in that space and what those products are. And you don't have to pick on any one vendor necessarily. I mean, if Cisco's in your wheelhouse, fine. Cisco's got tons and tons of documentation that will explain to you what their product set is and how it works. And some of them are freaking complicated how they do what they do. Start wrapping your brain around those concepts, because that is the one thing that's common to all the vendors, is they are really trying to tackle a lot of the same problems, albeit in different ways. So if you can get your head around the problems and then understand how the solutions that are out there are solving those problems, then you can stay a part of the conversation. It's less about certifications now. It's less about grabbing the book and learning OSPF and spanning tree. And it's more about just keeping up with what the heck is going on and how these products deal with the issues.
That's not new, by the way, because in the late 90s, that was exactly what was happening. There was only a limited set of OSPF standards, and you didn't actually – the OSPF standards that you had from Protean didn't integrate with 3Com's OSPF, didn't integrate with the WorldFleet OSPF, which didn't integrate with Cisco's OSPF. So this isn't new in the networking industry in the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a sort of a golden decade of stagnation where rooters haven't changed much. our routing protocols haven't changed. I mean, the last innovation we really saw in networking was MPLS, what, in 2003, 2004. And in the meantime, switches got a bit bigger as we went from 1 gig to 10 gig. And we went from, you know, I mean, we still got the CAT 6500. I deployed my first CATless 6500 in 1998.
So many things to say right now that I'll avoid.
Well, Dodge is making a new charger. And
but Ethan, more to your point, people think that you can just go out and there's like a, you know, a certified cloud networking guru certification that I can just pick up four or five books from your favorite vendor's press library and read it down. And it's not like that because we're trailblazing new technology that nobody has any kind of understanding of because everybody's still building it. I think back to the stories of when Stuart Biggs and Terry Slattery were taking the first CCI exam and Stuart handed Terry a box of parts and said, here, build a network out of this. And Terry's like, okay, how am I supposed to do this? You have to be able to understand, like you said, problems. Don't get hung up on VXLAN or NVGRE or STT or any of that. Understand what they're trying to solve with that solution. And then you'll know how to approach it when someone else comes and goes, hey, look at Shiny Box X. Shiny Box X fixes this problem because we do this. Well, actually, no, it doesn't because you didn't really address this issue, which is going to be a problem down the road for me. Crap, you sunk my battleship.
And I think there's something we forget every time something new and shiny comes out. Everybody gets sucked into it. And I think what gets lost in that is fundamentals.
Yeah.
We don't have to forget how switching works. We don't have to forget and not learn how layer three networks work.
And you better not either.
You can't because the way I've been telling my guys this, I've got this beautiful thing called a team now, which is awesome and I get to grow it, but it also means that I have to lead a little bit, which gets challenging and they're probably listening to this and laughing. But
what's Hi, guys. That's what a team's for.
Absolutely.
Is to remind you what you did wrong.
Thanks, Greg. Lots of confidence. But so often I keep telling these guys, let's just go back to the basics because where networking is going to go is you're going to have this big window, whether it's Cisco's management platform or, you know, whoever's, you're going to have this orchestration engine and you're going to point to A to B and stuff's going to happen until it doesn't. And when it doesn't happen, by God, you better understand layer two, layer three, and the seven protocol stack.
It's true, right? So you were saying, talking about fundamentals, because in the late 90s, it was really hard because we were doing token ring and FIDI and ATM and Ethernet, right?
Yeah.
And at that point in time, we had a lot of bridge protocols. So we had things like DECnet and AppleTalk and Banyan Vines and Apollo XNS all running over all of these different mediums, right? So it was very hard for us to see above that, to get over the parapet and see what was going on because we were just – if you've ever configured a OS2 computer over token ring running – NetBUI and integrating it with a PC with a FIDI adapter and you're going from token ring to FDDI and they're using NetBUI to talk to each other, right?
I can give you a perfect example of this. When I was an intern at IBM, we had a problem where there was an Ethernet backbone and token ring to all of our local machines. And we would double click on Lotus Notes and it honestly would take 35 minutes to open and nobody could figure it out. And finally some networking guy sat down and did a packet trace on it and said, well, the token ring MTU is 4,096 bits or 4,096 bytes. The Ethernet is 1536. So what's happening is three-quarters of the token ring packet is getting discarded as it launches onto the network. So what normally should have taken 10 minutes to open was really taking 30.
Yeah.
So we had to go around and hard cut all the MTUs on the switches. Or hard cut all the MTUs on the workstations in order to be able to fix that problem. But it's understanding how those two protocols talk to each other when they collide head on that there's no book for that.
So routing is still routing.
Yep.
So even in an SDN environment, Ethernet frames are still Ethernet frames. They need to be bridged. They need to be broadcast. They need to be unicast. They need to be, you know, unknowns need to be replicated at all the ports.
I just see this thing where we're getting into a world where you talked about you push a button and boom, your network's there, right? It's all done for you. So how many people are we going to have going, wow, that was really cool, and have no idea
how it works,
what's going on behind that? Because there's still stuff going on behind it. It's not just
– But that's not different to today. There's still plenty of people going up to a router and copying, pasting a text file that they got from somebody and saying, I just changed the IP addresses, but I leave all the rest of it the same, and it works, and I go on to the next site. I mean, if you've gone onto a Reddit if you've ever been to a Reddit stream and seen the networking thing there, and they just paste down a config and somebody says, yeah, you just go and paste this into your router, that will work. And they've got no idea what they're pasting into their iOS reader. But, you know, and that's what we've had for 10 years. But that's no longer good enough, right? Because what's happening is in the virtualized data centers or even in the campus LAN, right, we've now got Wi-Fi and wired, right? But Wi-Fi is getting much harder because laptops connect to Wi-Fi, iPhones connect, you know, your Android, your tablets and all that sort of stuff. So as those machines move around, your campus network isn't what it used to be. You know, a campus network in the old day or today is what, 48 to 1? 48 Ethernet ports, 48 1 gig Ethernet ports, 1 gig up in the backplane to get up in a nice organized hierarchical tree structure right the way up to the center. So if you want to talk sideways, you go up through the, you know, through the access into the aggregation, into the core, back down the aggregation, back down to the end, right? But that's not going to work in the future because you're going to be doing, people are going to start streaming video across your network, and that's going to go all the way up to the core and down the other side. So some of the big campuses, like we did that show with the university guys, and they've got 70,000 Ethernet ports in a single campus under one administrative zone. I mean, and you, people are going to start playing AirPlay over that. How do we solve those challenges on a Wi-Fi network where nothing is... You're not going to know that this is on – the only way that you're going to know that this phone is on that AP and roaming to that AP is if you've got some sort of software that tells you where it is, right? So we have – that's why controllers for Wi-Fi work is because they solve the operational problem. And that drove the design thing back to, you know, well, we have to have a controller to solve the operational problem so we can use a controller to drive. Controller networking's not new. It's been around for, since – I remember doing DLSW and SNA in the late 90s, and it was a controller. It was a thing called a front-end processor. A front-end processor is a controller network. Yep. All the networking was done in the...
But to that point, you've got companies now that understand that hardware controllers are a dead end. So you've got Meraki and Aerohive and other companies that are building software controllers that are management planes that exist in the ether, that can run those environments without necessarily needing to create a choke point. And I think that Wi-Fi in that regard is probably maybe six months to a year ahead of where network controller is there. If they would just stop and maybe watch a stream from Wireless Field Day, then they would figure out where they need to be headed.
So, but that's only network management. That's not new networking. That's just a tool that gives you a visibility of something in your network that you've not been able to see before. Well, you have been able to. You've been able to use network management tools from various vendors, but they've never been able to bring it together in a way that it's useful. But now we've got the ability to write software. Like, we didn't have Hadoop 5 years ago, right? Big data analysis, so you can actually now have a data center, a cloud system with a big Hadoop engine to do the correlation and the cross-analysis of the entire system. That's something we didn't have a decade ago. We had Microsoft SQL Server. You know, that's not, you know, and then in more recent times we've shifted to MySQL on a Linux platform. You know, things like Cisco's Prime still just uses a relational, you know, it still uses a database, but it doesn't do any freeform analysis or freeform. This is what changes, is that we can now write software as a management tool that is far different to what we could do 3 or 4 years ago, even. You know, look at how far SolarWinds has come in the last 3 or 4 years. That ability to have multiple programs and then bring them together and to unify them at speed. And yet we had Cisco Works from – I deployed my first Cisco Works in, you know, way, way back. And for 10 years it was a disaster. Because there are two reasons. One is because writing software was very, very hard. And B, SNMP – is a next to useless protocol. It's read only, right? So what we're seeing as part of the virtualization thing is this ability to write back to the configuration of the network. But none of our protocols, right? The idea of dynamically instantiating in a VLAN in a spanning tree environment, that's not that, you know, for most companies that would be like, you know, you'd have the CEO down on the, you know, if your spanning tree wobbles in your system and you're going to make a VLAN change, you know, 20 times a day because you're instantiating a new service, and your spanning tree can flap. Well, that's not the future, right? So, how do we solve those problems in the networking world? That's where, but that just means that you need to understand spanning tree, and you need to understand Ethernet, and you need to understand broadcasts, and you. So that it's not that nothing changed. It's just the way we go about it that changed.
The other trick, going back to the core, you've got to learn things that are outside of our core being. I mean, you can't just stick to network protocols anymore. If I was starting this all over again and straight out of college, I would do the normal Cisco track, you know, whatever I'm interested in, go down, learn the basics, and then I'd immediately jump to VMware. Or maybe I'd do VMware first, because there's a core set of things that outside of networking we have to understand around cloud and virtualization that until you jump over into that VMworld side of things isn't there. And
I would say, from a networking perspective, software switching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily all of the VMware stuff, because if you're a networking guy, there's a lot of stuff in VMware that might not interest you. Maybe you could care less about the storage infrastructure in a VMware environment.
I kind of totally disagree with you.
Oh, boy.
Totally. The reason why is because all of our storage protocols are now writing our networks. And all of the management protocols are already our networks, and now our load balancers are moving into virtualization planes.
I agree with that.
So I think we have to understand at least the core concepts. I don't think we have to go all the way up to VCDX or whatever it is, but I think we have to understand the core constructs of how this platform's working.
That's fair. Thank you, Josh.
You're welcome. I only kind of totally disagreed with you.
But as networking guys, we've always needed to know something about the applications. So I know enough about PHP and MySQL to know that the PHP web server makes queries to the MySQL, and that's a point-to-point connection, right? But if you suddenly instantiate a Ceph data store or a Gluster, I think Nutanix uses a Gluster. Cluster in this distributed storage engine?
I forget what they're doing at this rep. They've changed a lot in the last year.
Okay. So they're using a distributed storage engine. So that means that when they write a block of data down to their storage backend in the Nutanix thing, that it could go to any one of the servers in the cluster.
Yes.
So that means that you could be writing from one server to another server over here, and you don't actually know where that packet's going to go. That changes the way that you see the network. One is a point-to-point network protocol connection. The other one's a... Ooh, that's
roll the dice.
East, west, north, south. You know, you could write to this node. You could send your traffic to one part of the node, the Gluster node, but it would actually write it out to a different node over here. But it's got to raid that, so it might send it to four nodes to actually make sure there's redundant copies of each blade.
So the question of who do you bet on, and then how do you prep for it? There is no one great answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we said much earlier in the show that the big vendors are still going to be the big vendors. That's probably true. It's hard to bet against Cisco right now, you know, and Cisco has, whether or not you agree with their message, they certainly got a big bullhorn. They're going to keep preaching the gospel of Cisco One and network programmability, and it's all about APIs and that kind of thing. And we'll see what they do with the Cisco One controller, whether they're going to follow after HP and somewhat Big Switch and begin to deploy applications on top of that controller that then program the network for you, or if they're still going to go back to kind of where they were maybe 6 months ago and say, we're providing APIs and we're going to let the customer figure out the rest, which I don't see how that's going to happen. But anyway, back to the original point is that Cisco is Cisco, and you can't take away their market share. You can't take away their domination of the market in all sorts of different spaces. Mm-hmm. They're certainly not the only player in town, but I mean, if you want to look at somebody, they're a very safe bet as far as a company to pay attention to. The other thing to look at, there's a lot of startups out there, a lot of startups with some really interesting products. Startups aren't burdened by the bureaucracy and internal infrastructure of a Cisco, let's say.
There's also a few startups producing really crappy products that aren't solving a problem that anybody's got.
But that is fair. That's very fair. Yeah. But to make the point is that don't ignore the startups just because they're small. There's a good chance maybe they'll get gobbled up by a larger interest, or they'll have enough market penetration that something they're doing is going to be a leader of a paradigm shift that's in the industry.
I have a funny feeling that if you go out and you understand the problem as well as you can, and you find a vendor, maybe a startup, who's doing something really novel around that, and just keep up with them and learn how their solution works, either they're going to take over the market, or they're going to get subsumed by somebody who likes that product. You will see that material again in one form or another.
The good news is that every single vendor presentation in the first 5 minutes defines the problem. So,
yeah, you can watch almost any vendor presentation and get a good handle on the problem. That is true. Yeah.
Over and over.
So if you bet on Cisco, or you say that they're a safe bet.
I'm just using them as an example, Cisco, right, or really any significant vendor.
Well, I guess where I'm going with this is if we said that Cisco is a safe bet because of their size and their what they have the ability to do, does that mean that if someone is learning this stuff that their certifications are still the safe bet?
I think a lot of what we're talking about is a decade-long transition.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to change today.
Yeah.
We're going to see a lot of talk about SDN as vendors bring products to market. Who's going to buy these products and who's going to deploy them this year isn't really the question. It's a question of – the reason that I talk about them is because I'm looking 5 years in advance. Yeah. Part of my job is to be a leader in terms of what strategies and architectures. In terms of the networks that I actually physically work on today, they're all MPLS, OSPF, BGP, Spanning Tree. Yeah. Some of them are doing Fabric Path. You know, for example, I came across there's a part of my current employer. They're using Fabric Path between data centers, right? No. So in the past, we've always done Nexus 5500s with VPC, so you can bond the two connections together, so two 10 gigs between the data centers, and you've got a 20 gig pipe. And because it's a VPC, if it comes unstuck, you just lose half. You lose a switch, you lose a channel, whatever it is. Well, these guys have taken it a step further and said, well, I've got six data centers around the country, so I'm just going to fabric path them all together and do equal cost between all of them, right? And they're still using 5500s to do that. No ASRs, no OTV, no just Fabric Path Ethernet because they're all in the same, you know, 400 square mile radius. And that works perfectly well. That's just as good an answer as, you know, all the other things that, you know, all the other DCI technologies you've got. I mean, that's what I'm delivering today. But in a year's time, I need to have a way to solve my virtual networking problem. So in a year's time, I will have no servers connected to the physical network. All of my instances will be in VMs, and they'll be attached to a virtual switch. And that virtual switch has to work over my physical network. So I will have – and so all of the innovation, I think – well, innovation, but all the change we're going to see is going to be in the virtual switch. I think that's what we know because we get briefed by the vendors, and you know, the vendors are always talking to us about stuff, and it's always about the virtual switch.
Tons and tons and tons of energy going into making the soft edge, what's happening out at the hypervisor and the soft switch, right? The layer where the hosts, the virtual hosts are uplinking, that virtual switch doing something fancy, doing something, whether it's you're instantiating a tunnel at that point, whether you're putting access control list there for security reasons. All of the functionality seems to be way out there at the edge for the most part. Not everybody's looking at it quite that way, but that, you know, again, I think I made that point earlier. Understanding soft switches is,
VXLAN's going to be like...
That's a good specific technology to bring up as something worth getting a handle on, because VXLAN does seem to have a groundswell momentum behind it across several different vendors. Cisco's behind it. VMware certainly deals with it.
Intel, Red Hat.
Open vSwitch. You can terminate VXLAN in there. Yeah.
It could be a VXLAN gateway, yes.
Yeah. Mm. And then hardware termination as well from Brocade and Cisco, I think.
Arista as well, right?
Arista does hardware termination on a certain switch that has an FPGA, and Cisco can terminate VXLAN in the Nexus 1000.
Maybe not software, hardware. Yeah.
But they can terminate it in
software. I was thinking
software.
There was a hardware switch too.
They can bring it out of the VXLAN into the physical network via the 1000V supervisor, so the Nexus 1010.
Yeah, so VXLAN, as far as an emerging technology that's worth looking at, I think we're all nodding our heads as we're sitting around.
Yeah, that's
one worth getting to know.
And you need to start having a grip on server architectures. That doesn't mean understand the difference between an Itanium and an Intel, you know, whatever the current name of the processor. I don't even know what the latest Intel processor is.
That'd probably run out of weird names. Sandy Bridge, Ivy Bridge, Bridge to Nowhere. Yeah.
London Bridge.
Nahalem or whatever it is at the moment. But, you know, understand a little bit about CPU architectures and hypervisors because I believe that much of the future networking architecture will be software on VMs. Certainly that's part of what I'm doing is I'm now looking at instantiating software routers in VMs instead of using physical routers. And in my network in particular, it's because I can't charge back a physical networking device because I can't – I can take a VM and charge CPU cycles and memory capacities and storage and see. So if they want to burn X amount of CPU or X amount of memory and X amount of storage space, then my hypervisor, be it VMware or Microsoft or OpenStack, I can charge that back. So if I can put a router in and charge a customer for that router, that's a win. And it doesn't matter if that router is not quite as fast as a – because I can have 20 of them and I'm getting revenue off those. Whereas today, if I put a physical router up the front and share it between 20 customers, who's paying me for it?
No one. The other reason that's important is I've heard two or three vendors lately very specifically say we're not going to grow out a certain feature set in our core product because you can spin up a VM that does that just as well. And we don't want to go after that market, even though we see why you want that in our product. So I think that becomes key as well.
Well, it becomes back to this. So one of the design tenets that I keep running back into is this simplified core, complex edge. So MPLS, for example, is all about, you know, that the core of the network only switches on the MPLS tag.
Right.
And it doesn't know anything about what – it doesn't know – theoretically, doesn't know anything but the tag. That was the intention of MPLS. Time has gone by and they've added all sorts of rubbish on top of that to make it not quite that. But in the edge is all – and the PE is where all the complexity is. So the complexity is all distributed. And virtual switching is going to do the same thing. So your soft switch in your hypervisor is going to be where all the complexity is. And then you're most likely going to have tunnels across the network core between the virtual switches because that means there's no state in the networking core. And that changes your methodology because today we have these switches right at the top of the tree, you know, that big Nexus or the big, you know, the EX series, the Juniper EX chassis-based, you know, the heavy lead. And in there you have all sorts of fancy services, QoS and, you know, spanning and all that. But we're not going to use any of those features because they're all going to be buried inside of a tunnel so you can't see it. So we have to say big switching is over. We have to build these distributed edge architectures that just support very simple IP across the core but have funky stuff in the software vSwitch. That's what I think is.
That's a foreseeable architecture, even down to the enterprise. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of use cases.
Once it starts taking off in the cloud, you're going to have the software switching features are going to migrate into the enterprise because it'll be proven, it'll scale. Once it's been developed and they've made money out of it, it makes sense just to port it down to the enterprise space because they've already.
Yeah.
It's free money, right? Because every time you sell another software license, how much more did it cost you to manufacture it?
Microsoft model.
Well, one technology that we haven't really spoken much about that is probably worth getting to know at least a little something about is OpenFlow. Now, OpenFlow and SDN for a little while there were synonymous, although that's not really fair to say that anymore. But OpenFlow as a protocol is a way for the controller to tell switches exactly how to forward flows. Or what else to do with flows, not just forward them or drop them or do other things.
Or munge them.
Or yes.
Yes, right? Yeah. So one of the things that people forget is that OpenFlow can actually modify an IP frame or an Ethernet – sorry, an IP packet or an Ethernet frame and do something.
So I bring up OpenFlow just because it's got so much precedent, such a big buzzword out there. You can go to the Open Networking Foundation website, download the OpenFlow spec, start at the 1.0 PDF if you want because it's the shortest one, and you can get a very concise and solid understanding of what OpenFlow does and what its directives are. And you don't have to be – it helps to be technical, but you don't have to be super technical to get a grasp on what's going on when you read that document. Read that one, and then read the 1.3 spec, which seems to be where most vendors are headed after 1.0. They're working on releasing support for 1.3. Figure out what features got added in 1.3. Don't skip the appendices because that's where all the good stuff is in the 1.3 spec. And just understand what's going on there because that is another potential direction that we're going to see go. Now, there's a challenge with a lot of the established vendors who make their own ASICs, Brocade, Cisco, Juniper, et cetera, where what OpenFlow does doesn't map very well into their silicon. And so they're having a very hard time getting the kind of performance out of OpenFlow and flow munging that they can out of just straight packet and frame forwarding. Mm-hmm. And so the rich feature functionality that's there in OpenFlow, they can make their switches do it, these guys with their existing ASICs, But it's kind of ugly. I think you put it to me, Greg, in one show, strapping rockets on a camel. It's just, it's not, you know.
The camel will go a whole lot faster, but the outcome's not necessarily. Right. Well, I mean, hopefully we'll get to talk to Brent Salisbury in the next couple of days, and he's been doing some testing around OpenFlow products.
With real-world stuff and real-world applications, real-world switches, and seeing, okay, if I want to accomplish this and I'm going to use OpenFlow to do it, what kind of performance do I get and what kind of functionality is there?
And the other thing is start to think – so once you've learned a bit about virtualization, you've learned a bit about CPUs and memory and server architectures, because that's – now, that's no different to what we do today with physical routers. If you're a reasonably competent engineer, you understand a little bit about the internals of a router or the internals of a switch and how it works. Okay, you're going to need to understand that about that in a server architecture, because that's going to affect your forwarding performance and your, you know, networking capabilities. The other one is start to get familiar with a language like Python or Ruby.
Yeah.
Start
a scripting language, in other words. Or if you really want to go whole hog, learn C or whatever the current iteration of C is.
Java, most likely.
Yeah.
Java is going to be the most common language for writing network applications.
Everyone seems to be writing to Java and then whatever else you crazy people want to write to.
Yeah,
but Java is the de facto standard.
Which is
that's if you really want to get down into the guts, learn a full-on programming language. I said C, and I guess I meant Java. Okay. from a scripting language perspective, that's a tool that as a network engineer you're much more likely to use. Let's say Python seems to be the one that keeps bubbling up more even than Perl. These days,
Perl's fading a little because the community around it is not driving to the next generation.
But if you get a handle on a scripting language and understand how to write to libraries and APIs on the switch, then you can write your own scripts that talk to an API on a switch that make it do something, or to a controller perhaps.
Exactly. And the thing that two things about that. One is, in the old days. Again, we all scripted, right? I used to write Perl scripts in the late 90s to configure routers, because that was the only way. There were certain things that we could only do via Perl scripts, and we would, if we wanted to do route changes or, you know, various automation pieces, there was no network management platforms to do the monitoring of the systems. So it remains part of the future, right? That it's just the last few years we haven't needed to do this, so it's just something coming back into fashion. Network engineers used to be mad scripters, all right?
Yeah.
That faded for a while.
Sorry?
That faded for a while.
And it's my biggest weakness. It's one of the things that I came into at a point in time where I really didn't need it, and I regret it now as I've matured into new roles and wanting to do really cool things. I can't do it. I got to rely on other people because I don't have the time now to learn it.
Yep. So there's scripting, and keep in mind that scripting is also something that server people do. So even Microsoft has PowerShell. VMware has their CLI, right? Yeah. So you can't – it's not even the great Microsoft with all their clicky-clicky, you know.
Actually, Microsoft is becoming a lot more like that, because there are a lot of things inside their new applications like Exchange that can only be changed via PowerShell scripts. There's no GUI for it.
That's right.
The GUI for Exchange 2013 is just a pretty face on top of a whole bunch of PowerShell commands.
Well, and then Juniper is showing what you can do with Puppet to configure their equipment.
Exactly.
So, and that's supposed to be extended on to a broader product set.
So that's not that's not new. It may be new to some people in networking, but it's a trend across the entire industry.
Yeah.
Is that using scripting of some form, you'll need to be moving back into that skill set to glue over the gaps. Now, especially in an industry in transition, as we move from where we are in networking today and going through the SDN transition over the next 5-10 years, you know, there's going to be a lot of gaps when you're going to glue that over with scripts in the short term.
Yeah.
All right, I think we've pretty much covered off. I hope that the people that are listening were able to find happiness and joy and feel the enlightened sense that SDN will bring to you, because the being, it's the positive nature, the manna from heaven that will shower down upon you as the software-defined networking creates the pathway to nirvana will certainly lift you up on wings of freedom.
Oh. Yeah, you'd be spending a lot of time in bug tool. That's what that means.
Yeah, well, maybe so. But I think that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week, so, and we'd want to make sure that you come back. Before I go, I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Josh, what are you going to be doing in the weeks ahead?
This week's field day with you guys. And following that, we're heading back to launch two new data centers. So
launch. I've got this vision of a big red button and they're going to go,
I wish it was that easy.
Where can people find you?
You can find me at staticnat.com or on Twitter at JoshuaBrian77.
And Brandon?
Yeah, so after this week, I'll be back to the development digs.
Yep.
Working on more training. More and more. I can't stop. I love it. I love it. Can you tell? I love it. Yeah, I love it.
You're working on a CCIE security curriculum with INE, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, for version 4.
Version 4. Yeah, okay. good stuff coming out.
I've been talking to Nat Timms, and maybe I'll get you on, and we'll have a chat. Have a chin wag.
That'd be good.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
And Tom?
After this week, I'm going to go back to the real world, not nerd Disneyland, where I will hopefully be able to play around with a 100 gig link that requires SDN to work correctly.
And Mr. Banks, what about you?
Oh, the coming weeks for me include retiring a pair of 6500s that have desperately needed shutting down for quite a while since they went end of sale, end of life. They are the living dead. They are zombies, and they must go. So project right now is to migrate off. It's not much. It's about 200 or 300 switch ports and get them moved over to fexes that have been provisioned and are sitting there. We just got to figure out what the heck's plugged into those 6500 so that we can move them.
And they're the last ones that nobody knows what they are. So
there's a couple of guys that I work with that are right now auditing racks port by port and identifying everything and making sure that when we plug them back in, it's all going to be redundant this time and done right. And we've had those conversations, and it's great. So that and continuing to work on a phone rollout and lighting up a brand new Exchange 2010 environment. My job is just the load balancing and security side and that part of it. But that's a big project that's been ongoing. And, of course, writing on packet pushers and writing for network computing and whatever else happens.
Yes.
Yes.
It never ends, does it really? And of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at Ethereal Mind and on the Twitters as at Ethereal Mind. I've got a whole bunch of long-form writing projects coming up. We have some vendors coming out of Stealth that we're helping to work with, which is very entertaining for us and also interesting for them. Some new technologies, all SDN joyous.
Yes.
Acquire reversible things. So you may not see me quite so much because in my day job as a I work as the network architect for the Canopy Cloud during the day, and that is taking up an awful lot of energy as I work in that space. So I will be more peaceful than perhaps I am normally. As always, you can follow up on the show by going to the website at packetpushers.net. You can leave comments on today's show or head over to our forum where we can have discussions in longer form. And there's a bunch of people there who leave topics and discussions on a very regular basis. Send us an email at packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Or follow us on Twitter as at packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.